Hi everyone, just before we get this next History Hack out and going, just a quick reminder that there are lots of ways you can support the pod. Remember, just by liking, subscribing and sharing it with your friends, that is invaluable as it gets the word out and our witterings can go far and wide. But if you're able to support us financially, that would be incredible because it helps us keep doing what we're doing. In the description to this episode, there are links to Patreon where you can support the podcast regularly, and Ko-Fi, where you can tip us for an episode that you like. But we've also got some merch. So if you head to shop.historyhackpod.com, you'll be able to see some incredible bits of merchandise featuring the incredible designs that Steve Smith does for every episode. We've got some totes on there, some mugs, and we got more stuff coming all the time. So please do check that out. And if you are able to support us financially, that is incredible. Thank you so much. But even if it's just liking, sharing, and telling everyone we're incredible, that helps us too. So without further ado, hello and welcome to History Hack. We have a very sweet episode for you today, and we think we're going to have a lot of fun with this one because not only are we going to be talking about sweeties, I'm joined by the wonderfully sweet Bethany Moore, who's going to introduce our guest.
Thank you very much, Matt. It's a pleasure to join up you to carry out this podcast. So I'm really looking forward to this one as the resident History Hack sweet consumer. We are joined by Paul Crystal today. And Paul, when you read his biography, he's someone quite astounding, really. I've loved reading all of his books, and I've read a couple of his other pieces of work as well. It's absolutely fantastic. So he has a background in classics, where he's had degrees from the universities of Hull and Southampton. He's worked in medical publishing, and he's spent a lot of time as a historical advisor for organisations such as the National Trust, has written for national newspapers, and done a lot of broadcast work for various BBC radio stations. Since 2010, he's written over 120 books and articles, published on a wide range of topics from social and military history and classical history, all the way through to topics on food, including our book today, which is The History of Sweets, which I think has one of the best covers I've ever seen for a book. So hello, Paul. Welcome to History Hack.
Hello. Sounds like Desert Island Discs, this.
We like to keep it nice, simple and flowy. So thank you so much for joining us, Paul. So I will just start off with the most basic of questions, I suppose, when you talk about sweets. What makes a sweet sweet, and where do the origins of confectionery lie?
That's a good question, actually. The word sweet is originally Old English, although there are sort of crossovers with Scandinavian and Old Germanic languages. And the Old English word sweet, S-W-E-T-E, was originally used to describe something that was pleasing to the senses, mind, or feeling, and having a pleasant disposition. So it didn't take long for the word to be applied to something that was sweet to the taste, in much the same way as it also referred to a beloved one or someone who is a, what we call now, or used to call in the 50s and 60s, a sweetheart. A sweet is basically just that, it's sweet. And that's what makes a sweet a sweet. A sweet is sugar or sugar substitutes, the main constituent of a sweet. So it isn't difficult to see why we call sweets sweets. Sugar confectionery is a similar sort of thing. It is a sweet, it's any sweet confection, and that takes in chocolate, chewing gum, bubble gum, fudge, sugar candy, as well as other types of sweet. So sweet, the sweet, a sweet, sweets, is quite straightforwardly something that is sweet and that we like.
Wonderful. And so it's not just sweets as we know them has a long history, doesn't it? You know, it starts back in ancient history with honey and nuts, doesn't it, rather than the refined sugar that we would think of.
Yeah, well, before sweets in the format that we associate with sweets, i.e. small, very easily eatable tablets of sugar and sugar confectionery, before that, the way that the Greeks and Romans, for example, and other ancient civilizations, the way they got their sweet shot was through honey, a mixture usually of honey and nuts and other nice things that we associate really with, I suppose, Greek sweets and Turkish sweets and Indian sweets. But sweets as such didn't exist. It was basically honey.
And they've not always been the lovely snack that we know now. They've originally considered to have medicinal purposes. So the Mary Poppins, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. That's where a lot of it came from as well, Paul, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it's quite confusing, really, because in the sort of early days of the sweet, there weren't really sweets, actually. They came about almost by accident in the sense that sweets were essentially tablets. As you say, as with Mary Poppins saying that if you coat a medicine in sugar, then it's much more palatable to the refractory child who just spat everything out if it was bitter. So basically, medicines were coated in sugar or honey, and that allowed them to be tolerated by children. And when the tablets were just medicinal, they were called confections. And that's where we get the word confectionery from. It didn't take long for the confectioners, which were basically apothecaries or what we call chemists now, to realise that there wasn't that much money in the medicines, but there was a lot more money to be had in sweets. So they did away with the medicinal aspect and just started selling them as sweets. And that's where we get the word confectionery, and that's where we get sweets as we know them today, which is something that people enjoy.
Mm. Because there's still like a lot of sweets now that I would suppose some people might say like have medicinal elements to it, like cough drops and things. They're still very sweet and to make them palatable, aren't they?
Anyone who's ever taken a cough pastel, there's two types. There's the bitter ones that are not as popular as the ones where if you suck it and bite into it, then it explodes into a mixture of honey and other sweet additives that actually make it feel sweet. But it has got an element of medicinal in it in terms of it soothes your throat and it makes you feel a bit better psychologically. It doesn't cure your sore throat or your cough in any way, but that's what the manufacturers obviously sell it on, the fact that it is curing your cough and it's sweet at the same time.
Definitely. And obviously, sweets are extremely enjoyable, certainly for myself anyway. I love sweets, but we all know that there are certain health aspects. You know, there's a dark side to this most enjoyable of foodstuffs, isn't there? We've got usage of e-numbers and overconsumption, effects on health of obesity, dental hygiene even. So, you know, you must have come across a lot of these occasions where the sweets are actually detrimental to people's health. And I must ask you, as I got quite a scare when flicking through your book for the first time of finding a picture of rotten teeth in the book, it gave me quite a scare.
Yeah, well, that was the intention, not you personally, but I mean, I suppose in a sense we're in denial because there's convincing evidence, irrefutable evidence, that basically too many sweets, like too many anything, is not very good for you. And as you say, it has ramifications for dental health, which then translate into physical health, because if you have too many sweets and you're eating too much sugar, it rots your teeth. You end up in A&E, and A&E then have to sort it out. And one of the major reasons why children present at A&E is the fact that they've got rotten teeth and all the gunge that's coming out of their gums. Talk to an A&E consultant or registrar, and they will tell you that if we could get rid of all the sugar in sweets, we wouldn't see half as many paediatric patients. It's a terrible thing, and you could go on for ages. You know, people enjoy sweets, but there is, as you say, the dark side. And other aspects, of course, lead to diabetes, type 2, usually, and also to obesity. And they have all sorts of chronic health problems, which cost the health service tons of money every year, and also it leads to a shortening of your lifespan. But, you know, governments, successive governments, but particularly this one, the current one, is saying, well, okay, we're advising companies to do this and to do that, but it's not mandatory, it's voluntary. Which company that's making billions of dollars or pounds every year on flogging sweets to the market is going to change very much, certainly in terms of the sweetness, which is what attracts people to sweets in the first place? It's got to be mandatory. But it won't be.
Absolutely.
I guess we could add in the proliferation of sugar in just about everything.
Yeah, it's not just sweets, it's cornflakes and everything, as you say.
It's very prevalent, isn't it, really? I was thinking it as I was reading your book. Is it potentially a hang-up on the fact that in past generations, sugar was always an expensive product to buy. And as the world has become increasingly smaller and smaller and smaller, and these products are easier to get our hands on, then you had rationing in the Second World War. And it just seems that as we've had more accessibility to these kind of products, then the problem has become greater. I speak to my grandparents. My granddad has an excessive sweet tooth, but he grew up in the Second World War where, as a small child, where you didn't have access to those kind of products.
Well, it's interesting. There's a woman called Hannah Newton, who's a science historian at Cambridge. Basically, she maintains, and she's got evidence for this, that it's a common misconception that children's preference for sweet over bitter flavours is a modern phenomenon. It's not. It's been going on for generations and centuries. She says it's a reflection of infants' biology. It's a mechanism for survival. Just as pain tells the child that, you know, something's up and they've got to do something to counter it, taste buds are exactly the same. If a child, a baby, tastes something that's bitter, it's going to react to it and reject it. Taste buds are formed in the fetus at 7 weeks gestation, and within hours of birth, infants reject bitter tastes in preference to sweet ones. So it's always been with us, you know, from time immemorial. I don't really know that we can say that it's a modern phenomenon. It's not. It's always been there. Given the availability of sweets, as you say now, and given the option to have something sweet or bitter, the human being is always going to go for the sweet one. I mean, that's interesting research, but research is all very well. But if you can't implement it for the common good, it's not much point to it. But we're banging ahead against the usual brick wall on this. People get a lot of psychological pleasure from it. And, you know, that's got to be a good thing, because we do need, psychologically, particularly at the moment, lots of good things rather than bad things.
Absolutely. With the sweets I get through, I hope so.
Yeah. How are your teeth?
Do you know what? Surprisingly good, touch wood. I don't have any fillings or anything like that.
Yeah, that's because you're brushing your teeth properly. That's what that is.
Yeah.
So you're counteracting it.
I've watched you demolish a whole tub of sweets on some of our recordings, Beth. How are your teeth in such amazing condition?
I had to have multiple teeth taken out and braces as a teenager. So I think then I went the opposite extreme after the braces came off, because I wasn't allowed any sweets for 2.5 years.
Yeah, good. I'm not a dentist, by the way, so
I don't after too many movies of dentistry, I'm off dentists and I need to go see one. But let's talk about my favorite type of sweet. Let's get on to the chocolate here. I do feel this question is loaded, because it does bring us back to Birmingham, but the history of chocolate is absolutely fascinating, because it's not just the sweets that we've been talking about so far, but it goes way back to time immemorial. But it also is also the sort of chocolate bar that we know now is very much a British invention, is it not?
Well, it is and it isn't. Basically, as you probably realise, it all goes back to the Incas, the Mexican civilizations and such like. And, you know, they love their sweets. Montezuma III was a real avid sweet advocate. And basically, he liked sweets, not so much because they were tasty, but he thought they were an aphrodisiac. So the more sweets he had, the more, I suppose, good sex he was expecting. Anyway, you know, things didn't turn out too well for Montezuma, particularly when Cortes the Killer arrived and basically took his kingdom away from him. He went back to Spain with the recipe that he'd stolen from Montezuma, and things really kicked off in Spain originally. And then when the traders started calling in at Spanish ports, they were presented with this concoction, mainly, I suppose, it was much more akin to what you describe as gritty cocoa now. And it was for many years, it was in a liquid form. But anyway, the Dutch got hold of it and we got hold of it. Came back to Amsterdam and to London and such like. And eventually it developed into a solid sort of confection. The reason for that was that we had all of this cocoa stuff that was left from the liquid version of it, and no one really knew what to do with it. And there's a guy in Holland called Van Houten, who basically, I suppose, is the godfather of chocolate, because he invented a machine that actually made a good sort of fist at producing chocolate as we know it now in slabs. And if it wasn't for the Van Houten machine, we'd still be drinking gritty cocoa. But he developed it. Companies like Cadbury, Fry and Terry's took it on board. Roundtree were very sceptical about it, possibly because it wasn't English and it was foreign and all that stuff. Cadbury, Fry and the other manufacturers in France and so on, they took it, they embraced it, and they started producing chocolate as we know it. Yeah, and that's how it started. If you've ever been to Cadbury World, you'll get a good idea of how chocolate was produced in the early days and how it's produced now. Fascinating day out, Cadbury World.
Beth has season tickets.
That I can attest to as a...
Have you been?
Yeah, I'm from the area. I'm not a Brummie, but I do live very close by. And it's a rite of passage for anyone in the Midlands. You have to go to Cadbury World. And when you drive through at the right time of day and there's a smell of chocolate around the whole area.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm in York and you still get that here with the Kit Kats.
Mm. It's absolutely fantastic.
I live in the countryside. Really? We get different smells out here.
Yeah.
But this sweetened chocolate trade, all of the nice things that we like to enjoy, you know, whether you have them as a snack throughout the day or you have your chocolate bar after your dinner or something, it is a multi-million dollar pound industry, isn't it? It's such a huge market with such a huge audience, with some of the most iconic pieces of advertising as well being about sweet things. So you've got like the Haribo theme song, or you've got the milk tray man, or like Cadbury's with the gorilla playing the drums. It's so iconic. Why do you think sweets and sweet manufacturers, sweet producers seem to have hit on a really magic formula of being able to make their products really identifiable and really iconic? And it really does have quite a hold on the public imagination, I think.
Well, as you say, we all still remember adverts like the Lady Loves Milk Tray, the Cadbury's Fry adverts, sort of quasi-erotic thing. Don't forget the fruit gums, Polo the mint with a hole. They all speak to the market, basically, and that's the essence of good marketing and good advertising. They speak to ordinary people with the slogans and, you know, the tapping into James Bond or the Saint and, you know, that sort of thing. So the chocolate companies were very clever. They had to be, because the competition was so great. When Fry were launching something or Terry's, they had to spend money on the good agencies, and the good agencies were the ones that came up with the goods. So they appreciated that sweets are universal. In most countries, kids eat sweets and adults eat sweets. So, you know, they had a wide audience. They knew that once it had gone from radio onto television, that audience was, you know, basically a captive market. You know, in the middle of Coronation Street, stick an advert on for sweets and you were laughing. A good few of them are unforgettable. You know, they really are. And it wasn't just on telly as well. Some of the adverts in the papers, magazines, still, you know, they're still iconic. And, well, I hate the word iconic, but in those days they really were, because you can still see them in your mind's eye. You go on eBay and it's full of the reproduction sweet adverts. Sweets are very nostalgic. Mm-hmm. We all remember the Gobstoppers and the chewing gum, the bubble gum, all sorts of things. And that goes back to lots of things like summer holidays. We remember the good summer holidays and we remember the good sweets.
It's like that phrase, child in a sweet shop, isn't it? You know, because it's that just that amaze, the wonder of seeing a wall full of sweets.
You've got it absolutely right. That's exactly what it is. And there's a couple of pictures in the book that shows how literally gobsmacked a child is when it's the prospect of spending their threepence pocket money on some sweets that came out of a jar and were poured into a paper flute, and then you'd come out of the shop and you'd scoff them all.
It's not one of the questions we've prepped you with, Paul, so I'm going to throw this one in. You can refuse to answer it if you want. The thing I've always found fascinating as well with sweets and advertising is the differentiation between posh sweets and not posh sweets. And I suppose the classic one for that is the Ferrero Rocher, isn't it? Yeah, it's been served at the ambassador's dinner, whereas your bar of dairy milk is sort of your bog standard.
Yeah, or your Mars bar. Mm.
Yeah. Has it always been like that? Have we always tried to make some sweets better than other sweets?
If you look at the old catalogues, which are brilliant pieces of art in themselves, the reps catalogues for companies like Terry's, like Cadbury, like Craven, which is a lesser known company, But if you look at them, you know, the amount of money that companies spent on their seasonal catalogues, particularly the Easter and Christmas ones, it's phenomenal. They'd have someone draw the suite, and then they'd have another person paint the colours in. And they're works of art, they really are, and fascinating. So when you had companies like Terry's doing the selection box, basically, well, not a selection box, but the box of sweets that had 23 different flavours and fillings in, that was a bit posh. It was a posher than your Spangles or, you know, your M&Ms later on. So they were a bit poshed up, and you'd spend a bit more money on them. And as time went by, then obviously as disposable income increased, as it did in the 60s and 70s, boxes of chocolates got posher as well, until you got to the zenith of them, which I suppose is what you said, Ferrero Rocher. Everyone likes a Ferrero Rocher. But the advertising was quite clever, because it made Joe Bloggs in the street feel as though he was something of an ambassador when he gave his box of chocolates to his wife or partner or whatever. So, yeah, that was very clever. And they were posh sweets. They were poshly wrapped individually, and they came in posh boxes. But it also meant you feel a bit posh as well.
I guess it just reflects my soul that I do like a good dark chocolate.
Well, again, you know, there's all sorts of stuff about the difference between milk and dark chocolate. Dark chocolate has got proven benefits to heart health and such like. You know, obviously, you only take a few, you know, you have one or two a day. But if, you know, if you've got a chronic heart disease, it does help to a small extent. Yeah. So, yeah, keep taking the dark chocolate.
I keep saying that to my doctor. I do eat a lot of dark chocolate. And he's like, not that much.
Yeah. What does he say? She say.
I don't think you're supposed to be eating that much to help your heart.
They always say that.
Yeah.
Something silly like 2 squares a day. I heard on Radio 4 the other day.
How big are the squares, though? Like, how big is that?
Square can be a whole bar, can't it?
Well, yeah, that's one square, right? Surely, if you think about it, one block, one square, you eat it in one go, one square.
If you rub the little indents out, you can make it all one big block.
Yeah.
I think the makeup of sweets is fascinating, and you know, chatting to Beth about your book is some of the little tidbits and fascinating little stories about the history of the sweets that we know so well. And I guess, Paul, what is sort of the favorite bits that came up in your research? I think Beth was saying about Polos being delayed by 30 years or something silly like that.
The Nazis, I mean, they were so desperate to get Lebens around and invaded Poland in 1939 without any consideration whatsoever for Roundtree, who were desperately trying to launch Polo and had to delay it for some considerable amount of time because you couldn't really launch a Polo in the middle or the beginning of a war. So, yeah, because the invasion took place around about the same time as the launch was scheduled, they had to delay it for some time,
yeah.
Which was a shame, really, because they'd spent a lot of money prepping the market for it, and it couldn't be for a while. Yeah, but Polos are fascinating in themselves. It's the only sweet that is famous for what's not there rather than what is there, because it's famous for the hole in the middle, which is basically the confectionery equivalent to a black hole. You can't really get to it because it doesn't exist.
I remember reading in the book, you'll have to correct me if I've mixed myself up, but you wrote something about it's the love heart sweets with, you know, with the phrase, yeah, I love you. And there was something about the flavours, wasn't there? How the flavours became the flavours for what the drumstick lollies.
Love hearts, which we all know. Well, I don't know. You're maybe too young.
No,
I remember love heart.
I love a love heart.
Beth knows all sweets.
They started well before the love hearts hit the market. Terry's of York that sort of invented them, and they were basically just sweets that had those messages on, which eventually became love hearts. And they were very, very popular.
There was something that you referenced about there was a child that were involved with tasting the process, and then the flavours became the raspberry and like the milky flavour that you associate with the drumstick lollies. I can't remember it exactly off the top of my head, but it was a fascinating little section of all these little facts, and like Palmer violets as well. Incredibly underrated sweet, the Palmer violet.
I've not actually heard of that sweet that you just mentioned. Palmer Watchmanjiki.
Palmer.
Yeah. Caveat this, I am foreign.
You are foreign. I love Palmer violets, but they've got a bit of a, like, some people really, 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 really don't like them. They're almost like a marmite. I almost feel like Palmer violets are one of the sweets, I would say, are the marmite of the sweet world, because people either really, really love them or really, really hate them. There doesn't seem to be anyone who just goes, eh, they're all right.
Yeah, the smell alone tells you it's a Palmer violet and nothing else.
Yeah, it's very iconic. Absolutely. Yeah. Obviously, we've heard Matt's favourite is he loves a good bit of dark chocolate, and we know that I am a complete aficionado for sweets of all varieties. But if I had to pick one sweet,
of all sweets, then
one sweet of all sweets, I'd probably have to go very classic. I'd probably have to go with something like a lemon sherbet. I love a lemon sherbet. So obviously, with this book being about sweets, we can't not ask you, Paul, what's your favourite sweet?
Well, I like things like lemon sherbets, because when you've sucked them for a bit and then you crunch them with your molars, they do explode with the sherbet, and that is quite a sensation, really. And I remember every Sunday after we'd listened to, well, I didn't listen to it, it was on the radio, you'd have the Billy Cotton Band show, you then have your Sunday roast, and then me mum used to give us, me and my brother, some money to go down to the sweet shop, and we could get a load of sweets, and then we'd come back and watch a John Wayne film or something like that. That was a typical Sunday. It never changed for years until we went and lived abroad and there was no Billy Cotton Band show and no sweet shops like you have in England. So anyway, we'd do that, and you know, any sweet like that was something that you liked. But I suppose as I got older, I think the two sweets that I did like best and probably were chocolates, really. One was a crunchy, and one was a bounty bar. Oh. And the thing about them was, the first thing you did with it, obviously unwrap it, and then you'd start nibbling away at the chocolate on the outside until you were left with the honeycomb, and then you'd eat the honeycomb separately. And the same applied to a bounty bar. You'd eat the chocolate round the side, and then you'd be left with all of that sweet coconut. Yeah, so I still like them. I must admit, though, because for various reasons, I've never had either for probably about the last 10 years. But they're the sort of things I liked, and they're still making them, thank goodness. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, crunchy's a good one.
Yeah, not good for your teeth,
though. No. I think if there was something I had to pick as well, I do love Haribo. I can just sit there. Oh, and as Matt can attest to, I will demolish a whole bag of Skittles in one go. So, you know, anything really, I think is for most people, if you put something in front of them, it's just go for it.
I remember Skittles. Do you know where the brand name Haribo comes from?
I do, but I can't remember it. So let us know, Paul, and our listeners.
It was the first part of the family-owned company's founder, Hans Riegel. So it's H-A, and then he stuck an I in it. And the B-O comes from Bonn, German city, where the company was founded. Simple as that. Mm. That's another example of where simplicity lasts forever.
It's a very German sort of concoction, same as sort of Adidas as well, being Adi Dassler.
Just
remove some letters and put it all together. We've got ourselves a brand.
There's quite a few examples of that. Jelly Babies have got a real good story. They were called Peace Babies when they were first developed after the end of the First World War. And then they morphed into Jelly Babies. Mm. And they psychologically, they satisfy the human need for cannibalism, because everyone bites the head off first.
Oh, see, I don't go head first. I go feet first and make them suffer.
That's a gender thing, maybe. I always went for the head. Then at least you know you've got a dead jelly baby.
I'd always give them a squidge first. I don't know what that says about me.
Yeah, they were peace babies. As you know, if you look through the book, there's loads of stuff in it like that.
Definitely.
Yeah. Being Canadian, we do have some weird and wonderful sweets of our own. And
Mars must have had a big impact in Canada, did it? Mars bars and such like, which very complicated when they transferred over to Europe.
One question while we've got you here, another one we haven't prepped you for really, is does a sweet necessarily have to be sugary goodness? Because Beth and I were talking about licorice earlier. So yeah. where does that come in? Because we're opposites here. She's a non-licorice sort of person, whereas
I can't deal with licorice.
Licorice is a story on its own. A lot of it is grown very close to where I am now. It's grown in South Yorkshire, basically. And there's a licorice triangle which goes from just south of Sheffield up to Leeds, and that's where most of the licorice is made. There's probably about 7 or 8 licorice companies based around Pontefract. Mm. And that's where you get Pontefract cakes from and such like, which are made from licorice. John Betjeman actually wrote a poem, The Licorice Fields at Pontefract. They were so famous and so unique in a way. But yeah, there was loads of companies that just made all the money out of selling licorice. But yeah, you either like it or you don't.
I didn't know it was a Yorkshire thing.
Oh yeah, very much so.
That's fantastic. My mind is slightly blown by all the licorice I've had and all the places around the world, and its roots are Yorkshire.
Probably from Yorkshire.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a rhubarb as well. Not a lot of people know that most of the rhubarb in the UK is grown around here, around about Leeds. It's rhubarb city. Really.
I do like a good rhubarb and custard.
Yeah, there you go. Try rhubarb and licorice together. See what that's like.
Two very different reactions there from.
Yes, dear listener, if you could see the video, my face lit up and Beth's went very dark very quickly.
Yeah.
Rhubarb, yes. Yeah. Licorice, no.
No. Yeah. We're going to have to bring you around to the dark west. Thank you for joining us, Paul, because that has been utterly fascinating. And I am now, I'm oddly craving licorice just to annoy Beth.
Well, yeah, get online. I'm sure you'll be able to get some on Amazon by tomorrow, by 3 o'clock.
And we just like to say, we shall make sure that your book is on our bookshop as well.
It is one of the most beautiful book covers I've ever seen. I did just sit and stare at it going, this just is a beautiful cover to look at.
Well, I'm glad you said that. It is eye-catching, if nothing else. It was originally a hardback with a plate section, then they looked at it and they looked at the plates and they said, oh, we need more plates and we'll put it right through the book.
Well, the sweets clearly photograph very well because that is quite some cover. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. That's been a delight.
Thank you for joining us, Paul. I've loved this episode.